Sri Chaitanya Manubhistam Stapitam Dena Bhutale Sayam Pukadamayam Dadati Sa Pandantikam Vansikapatu Vyascha Kripasandhu Vaivasa Pakitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah. Let's call for the chapters about Jetbarat. Now we're on chapter 13, and the teachings of Jetbarat will also include chapter 14. In chapter 8, 7, we heard about the activities of Bharat, King Bharat, who took over from his father, Rishabhdev, as king. And in chapter 7, we heard how he performed sacrifices after sacrifice, but in his mind he was worshipping the Lord. He wasn't worshipping the demigods, although the demigods were named in the sacrifice. He was seeing that the demigods were part of the universal body of the Lord, so he was worshipping just part of the Lord. That was his mentality, because the mentality or consciousness determines the quality of one's activity. And then finally, after ruling for quite a long time and achieving great purity of the heart and ecstasy, he renounced and went to Pulaha Ashram, where the Gandaki River flows high in the Himalayan mountains. Then Bharat Maharaj, somehow or another, by a quirk of fate, became attached to a deer. He made his faults were in that he didn't consult his spiritual master, and even though he had renounced everything, his whole family as not required and is in the way of his spiritual advancement at this particular time, he still became attached to an animal, an insignificant animal, and he died thinking of that animal. That was in chapter 8. Then in his next life he became a deer, because he died thinking of a deer. Yam yam vapi smaram bhavam. That's at the end of 8. And then in the life following that, he became Jetbarat. He took birth in a Brahmin family. So in those two births, as a deer and as Jetbarat, he had the grace of the Lord and could remember his previous lives. And therefore, in his life as Jetbarat, he was very, very careful, and he had decided to make sure that this was his last life. And he decided not to become at all entangled in materialistic life. And he wanted especially to avoid association that might entangle him. So what did he do? He acted as if he were a dullard and retarded and deaf and dumb, and he wouldn't do anything properly. His father tried to teach him the proper etiquettes, sadachar of a brahmana. He tried to teach the shastra how to chant the mantras properly, and he wouldn't learn them. He would do everything oppositely. His father died after some time. His brothers exploited him. They didn't treat him sweetly, and they just put him in the forest to guard the fields. And one day, they didn't feed him properly or anything. Then one day a group of thieves and rogues took him, and they thought that they would offer him to the goddess Kali. because they needed a human being who was not quite a human being to offer. It was a concocted system, but this is what they were doing. And the goddess Kali, when they tried to kill Dadbharat, burst out of the statue and killed all the thieves, along with her associates. They killed all the thieves. And Dadbharat, during this time, he was just fully focused on his eternality and his relationship with Krishna. He was fully focused on the eternal platform, so he was undisturbed by these horrendous external occurrences. Then finally, he was wandering. He had left home by that time, and in chapter 10, he was conscripted into the service of the king of Siberia as a palanquin carrier. But he wasn't able to do that properly because he couldn't carry the palanquin straight because he was so nonviolent he wouldn't step on any of the ants that may happen to be in the way, and he was always looking out for them. So the king chastised him, and this great soul, Dadbharat, began to speak to the king. And he said that your sarcastic words are true in a real sense. You said that you must be so fatigued and tired. And what you're actually saying is you're not fatigued and tired. You're so strong. So actually it's true that I am not fatigued, nor am I tired, because I'm the soul. So my body may even be fatigued, but I'm not fatigued. I'm an eternal soul. So he spoke in quite a few ways from this very, very high spiritual platform. And the king immediately realized that he had committed a great offense by conscripting a sage into this menial service. And he begged his forgiveness, Dadbharat's forgiveness, and he asked him many questions. The first beginning with, what is the ultimate shelter? And then how could I advance to that shelter? And then he said, seems to be contradictory. He asked him philosophical questions too, based on what Dadbharat had said. He said, your words seem to be contradictory. I can't understand them, because clearly, even though the soul is different from the body, clearly the bodily activities, what happens externally, clearly affects the soul. Because I'm the one feeling tired. Even though the body may be tired, it is me who's providing, the soul is providing consciousness that experiences the tiredness. So how could you say there's nothing to do with the soul and the body? And also we see that the body, for instance, I'm the king, and you've said that I'm not the king and you're not the servant, but yet, because we're souls, but yet we see that the king's activity of in making sure that the citizens perform their prescribed duties according to the Vedas, it causes purification to their consciousness, to their hearts, which brings them closer to God, which brings them closer to eternal truth. So therefore, we see that temporary things, even though my position as king may be temporary and their position as citizen may be temporary, we see that temporary things do affect the eternal. So please remove these doubts for me. So he asked some questions about removing doubts or what he thought was contradictory, and he had asked also about the ultimate shelter and how to advance towards it. So then in the 11th chapter, Dadbharat began to reply, and he began his reply by chastising him and saying, this is very foolish what you're saying, that there is a connection. Actually, this is just on the practical level that we experience it, but actually speaking, not on this external level, practical level meaning the external level, but on the ultimate level, there is no connection at all. It's like a dream. And all this whole dream that we're experiencing is real. What is causing us to experience it is real. It is just simply the mind. And because our mind is full of so many desires and false identifications based on false ego, this causes us, the soul, who is enwrapped within the subtle body, and the gross body is based on the subtle body, this causes the soul to experience birth after birth after birth. It causes him such entanglement in the material world, birth after birth. It causes him misery, birth after birth. So therefore, rather than listening to what the mind is saying and allowing it to become filled with so many desires, what should we do? We should learn to neglect the mind, because the mind is the cause of our material existence. We have to learn how to neglect the mind, otherwise it will fill us, it will carry us throughout the material world. So when, after Bharat Maharaj, Rahugana Maharaj heard all this, he said, he offered his respects, and this is what we heard yesterday, and he thanked Dad Bharat for his nectarian instructions, and he asked them to repeat those instructions in a simple way about how it's all caused by the mind, and the mind causes our entanglement in the material world. And he wanted to understand this very clearly, so please repeat it in a simple way. So what Jad Bharat began to do is explain the actual shelter of the living entity. What is the principle what is the ultimate principle? So he started, and this is what we heard yesterday in chapter 12, with trying to say, what do we think is the principle? First, we think that I'm me, and you think you're the king, and you think I'm a palanquin carrier. But clearly, whether you're the king or the palanquin carrier or the trees or the people, other people walking by, we're all just composed of earth. So higher than the principle, more basic, not higher, but more basic than the principle that you should do your prescribed duty as the king, is there's a oneness that we're all composed of material level. But yet that's not the highest principle. We're all composed of earth. And temporarily we're in these forms, and then in 100 years we'll be back to the material, we'll be back. We won't exist anymore in this form. But as a more basic principle than that is that the earth is also composed of things. It's composed of atoms. And the atoms, more basic than that, the atoms are ultimately not the cause of everything. It's just different configurations. Everything is just different configurations of atoms. And ultimately, the cause of everything, all those things are unreal. Unreal meaning temporary. They don't have true existence. So we want the shelter that has true existence, the principle that has true existence. And that principle that has true existence is Jnanam Vishuddham, pure knowledge, Paramatam Mekam. So that was the 11th verse of the 12th chapter, which described the ultimate truth. That this ultimate truth is that which everything else comes from. Janmad yasyataha. Everything else comes from that, and there is only one ultimate truth, but it can be seen in three different ways depending upon the methodology used to view it. And those three ways are either is Brahman, Paramatma, or Bhagavan. You can see everything is the energy of the Lord, or you can see that the Lord in His form pervades everything. Or one can see actually or understand or experience the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in that way, he's explained the answer to the first question that Rahugana Maharaj asked way back in chapter 10, about what is the ultimate shelter. And this absolute truth is the ultimate shelter that can be realized in three ways. And the ultimate of the ultimate shelter is Bhagavan. And then he starts to answer the next question about how to make advancement. And he describes that, first of all, in the negative, by explaining that by following all the rules and regulations, etc., etc., performing austerities, one doesn't make advance. One can't understand the absolute truth, but one needs to smear his body with the dust of the lotus feet of a devotee. And then, I didn't mention it, but in chapter 10 also, he asks about his history. How is it that you were wandering around like a ordinary person? And we've inscripted you to be a chariot driver, but you're a great sage. So what happened? So how did you become like this, in this position? So he explained that previously he was Bharat Maharaj, and now he's just trying to avoid all unfavorable association, and he's wandering around fully realized. So now we're up to chapter 13. And in chapter 13, he's going to go back and describe in a simple way what he's described in chapter 11, how the mind, in one sense, is the cause of everything. And basically, this is going to be described in chapter 13 and 14, going to show again that we don't, to push us out of the material world and the material conception of life. Because the material conception of life is basically our mind's desire to enjoy matter. So we have to break this tendency that we all have. Because based on that tendency, we are caused to take birth after birth after birth. The soul which is eternal, which is never born, which never dies, is forced into this suffering situation. So although the Vaishnava philosophy is really neutrality towards the material world, that in any situation, if our consciousness is right, we don't decry any situation, we just accept every situation as Krishna's mercy and use it in Krishna's service. That's actually the Vaishnava conclusion. But Jad Bharat is preaching more a Gyan conclusion, showing how material life, if approached from a materialistic point of view, from the point of view of us trying to enjoy life, if the mind is full of the principle of enjoyment, then that causes our continuation of the cycle of birth and death. So therefore, he's explaining, he's trying to break this tendency for the living entity to enjoy, for the mind to be full of plans for enjoyment, which cannot bring us happiness. So, very much anti-material preaching. And we've heard this in the third canto very, very strongly. In Kapila Muni's teaching, when he describes the adverse effects of fruitive activities, of birth in the womb, and then the prayers, and then coming back out and becoming entangled, and that causing further births and deaths. And then we've heard it in the fourth canto, in the story of Paranjana. And now we're going to hear something very similar in the fifth canto, these two chapters where Jad Bharat preaches very strongly against material life. Material life doesn't mean exactly living in the living life in the material world. It's the consciousness of I am enjoying that keeps us in the material world. So Rupa Goswami taught this so strongly. Yukta Ravagya Uchite. Yukta Vairagya. The kind of renunciation that is based on the material world isn't mine to enjoy, so how am I, it's Krishna, so who am I to renounce the material world? Rather, I have renounced the enjoying spirit, and the material world will be used in Krishna's service because it's Krishna's. The devotee, whether he's in heaven or hell or in the spiritual world, he has only one thought: how to please Krishna. He doesn't even long to get out of the material world, because what's in his heart is to please Krishna wherever he is. So Mahaprabhu has prayed, Janmani Janmani Shreva Vattar Bhakti Haita Gita. So chapter 13. So he's going to explain that same teaching that he taught in chapter 11 about how the mind, he's trying to remove this enjoying tendency from the mind, because that causes, the mind causes our entrapment in the material world. So he's going, and Jet Bharat and Maharaj Ruhuguna has asked him to explain it in a simpler way, so he's going to explain it very strongly here in the form of a story. Now, in the 14th chapter, the parallels, the analogous points in the story are revealed, and Prabhupada puts them very much in the purports of this 13th chapter. So, although the 14th chapter explains this story, we'll get the explanation in the 13th chapter too. So, O King Rahugana, in this forest, Jadbharat, who had fully realized Brahman, continued, "My dear King Rahugana, the living entity wanders on the path of the material world, which is very difficult for him to traverse, and he accepts repeated birth and death. Being captivated by the material world, under the influence of the three modes of material nature, Sattva-guna, Rajaguna, and? I wasn't looking specifically at you. Sattva-guna, Rajaguna, and? Tamaguna. The living entity, influenced by this, can see only the three fruits of activities under the spell of material nature. So just wandering on the path of material life, we only see the fruit, we're wandering fruit, what we will enjoy in the future. And that's what people are doing all day long. They're always thinking of their future enjoyment, and that's called fruitive work. Working very hard to get some future enjoyment. So that's all people see. They don't see how this road that they're on is so difficult, and it's causing them so much misery, actually. And really it's causing them to accept birth and death. But wandering on this path, these fruits are auspicious, inauspicious, and mixed. Good, passionate, and bad. Ignorance. He thus becomes attached to religion, economic development, sense gratification, and the monistic theory of liberation, merging with the Supreme. He works very hard, day and night, exactly like a merchant. Now here's the point of the analogy. He's just like a merchant who enters a forest to acquire some articles to sell later for profit. Now, in Australia, there's not direct experience of this at this point, but in the early days, even in Australia or the United States, or so many countries, before, while you were allowed to do these things, this is someone who didn't have any business or anything like that, he could go to wander in a place, and he would find different things that he could bring back to the city and sell. So a merchant, so the living entity is like a merchant who enters the forest to acquire some articles to sell later for profit. However, he cannot really achieve happiness within the material world. So we enter material life searching for happiness. We undergo the difficulties of forest life, so to speak, so we can gain something that will bring us enjoyment. So working very hard to try to get some future happiness is called the world of Maya. Because actually, no one can get happiness in the material world. Now, so continuing with the analogy that Bharat says, O King Rahugana, in this forest of material existence, there are six very powerful plunderers. So he enters the forest, and immediately, you work very hard, you know, acquiring things in the forest. It's dangerous there. There are so many problems. And there are plunderers there who take the things that you've acquired. Now, what are these plunderers that will perhaps will be described? When the conditioned soul enters the forest to acquire some material gain, the six plunderers misguide him. He sees someone, he says, could you tell me where I could find the musk deer so I can get some musk to bring back and sell in the forest? Out of the forest in the city? And they say, yes, just go this way. And they send him to where their cohorts are waiting for him, and they attack him. So they misguide him. Thus the conditioned merchant does not know how to spend his money, and it is taken away by these plunderers. Or I will sell you something, don't worry about it, here it is. Like tigers, jackals, and other ferocious animals in a forest that are ready to take away a lamb from the custody of its protector, the wife and children enter the heart of the merchant and plunder him in so many ways. So one is harassed by family, disease, and in this way, one, due to the harassment, forgets that there is an aim of life. He's just being plundered here and there. In this forest, there are dense bowers composed of thickets of bushes, grass, and creepers. In these bowers, the conditioned soul is always disturbed by crueling, biting mosquitoes, which are envious people. Sometimes he sees an imaginary palace in the forest, and sometimes he's bewildered by seeing a fleeting fiend or ghost, which appears like a meteor in the sky. Here's Prabhupada's purport. The material household is actually a whole of fruit of activities. To earn a livelihood, one engages in different industries and trades, and sometimes one performs great sacrifices to go to higher planetary systems. Apart from this, at least everyone is engaged in earning a livelihood in some profession or occupation. In these dealings, one has to meet many undesirable people and their behaviors compared to the biting of mosquitoes. This creates very undesirable conditions. Even in the midst of these disturbances, one imagines that he's going to construct a grand house and live there permanently, although he knows that he cannot. So this is imagining a palace in the sky. One may see that, but one is imagining that he's going to build a big, big house and how wonderful it's going to be. And the people, when one has to deal in the material world, sometimes one meets nasty, nasty people. And even though one doesn't meet them and stay with them for very long, but one has to deal with them because this is business. And they're compared to the mosquitoes. Gold is compared to a quickly fleeting fiend, which appears like a meteor in the sky. It displays itself for a moment and is then gone. Generally, karmis are attracted to gold or money, but these are compared here into ghosts and witches. Because you seek these things, and you can't capture them. My dear king, the merchant on the forest path of the material world, his intelligence victimized by home, wealth, relatives, and so forth, runs from one place to another in search of success. Sometimes his eyes are covered by the dust of a whirlwind. And that is to say, in his lust, he is captivated by the beauty of his wife, especially during her menstrual period. Thus his eyes are blinded and he cannot see where to go or what he is doing. Purport. It is said that household attraction resides in the wife because sex is the center of household life. Yan matunadi grihamedi sukam hitucham. A materialistic person, Prabhupada says, making his wife the center of attraction, works very hard day and night. His only enjoyment of material life is sexual intercourse. Therefore, kamis are attracted to women as friends or wives. Indeed, they cannot work without sex. So one becomes blinded or enamored, sets up a house to enjoy, and becomes blinded in that circumstance by the wife and the enjoyment she offers. Wandering in the forest of the material world, the conditioned soul sometimes hears an invisible cricket making harsh sounds, and his ears become very much aggrieved. Sometimes his heart is pained by the sounds of owls, which are just like the harsh words of his enemies. Sometimes he takes shelter of a tree that has no fruits or flowers. He approaches such a tree due to his strong appetite, and thus he suffers. He would like to acquire water, but he is simply illusioned by a mirage, and he runs after it. So in the dense forest of material life, there is so much suffering for him. His desire and his dream is happiness, but what he actually gets is suffering. In Srimad Bhagavatam purport, it is said that the Bhagavad philosophy is meant for people who are completely free from envy. Paramo namatsaram. The material world is full of envious people. Even within one's inner circle, there is much backbiting, and this is compared to the sound vibration of the cricket in the forest. One cannot see the cricket, but one hears its sound and becomes thus aggrieved. It's like sometimes amongst your friends, you suddenly hear a rumor about yourself. You know, that you did this and you did that, you know, critical, nasty rumor. And no one started it. It's like an invisible cricket, but you hear it sort of wandering around and causes aggrievement. When one takes to Krishna consciousness, one always hears unpalatable words from relatives. This is the nature of the world. One cannot avoid mental distress due to the backbiting of envious people. Being very much aggrieved, sometimes one goes to a sinful person for help, but he has no means to help because he has no intelligence. Thus the living entity is disappointed. This is like running after a mirage in the desert in an effort to find water. Such activities do not produce any tangible results. Due to being directed by the illusory energy, a conditioned soul suffers in so many ways, so he's wandering in the forest. Sometimes the conditioned soul jumps into a shallow river. While being short of food grains, he goes to beg food from people who are not at all charitable. Sometimes he suffers from the burning heat of household life, which is like a forest fire. And sometimes he becomes sad to have his wealth, which is as dear as life, plundered by kings in the name of heavy income tax. Purport. When one is hot due to the scorching sun, one sometimes jumps into a river to gain relief. However, if the river is almost dried and the water is too shallow, one may break his bones by jumping in. The conditioned soul is always experiencing miserable conditions. Sometimes his efforts to get help from friends are exactly like jumping into a dry river. By such actions, he does not derive any benefit. He only breaks his bones. Sometimes, suffering from a shortage of food, one may go to a person who is neither able to give charity nor willing to do so. Sometimes one is stationed in household life, which is compared to a forest fire, samsaradava nalalita loka. When a man is heavily taxed by the government, he becomes very sad. Heavy taxation obliges one to hide his income. But despite this endeavor, the government agents are often so vigilant and strong that they take all the money away, and the conditioned soul becomes very aggrieved. Thus people are trying to become happy within the material world. But this is like trying to be happy in a forest fire. No one need go to a forest to set it ablaze. Fire takes place automatically. Similarly, no one wants to be unhappy in family life or in worldly life, but by the laws of nature, unhappiness and distress are forced upon everyone. Text 7. Sometimes, being defeated or plundered by a superior, powerful agent, a living entity loses all his possessions. Sometimes some thieves come in and steal everything. He then becomes very morose, and lamenting their loss, he sometimes becomes goes unconscious. Sometimes he imagines a great palatial city in which he desires to live happily with his family members and riches. He thinks himself fully satisfied if this is possible, but such so-called happiness continues for only a moment. Prabhupada's purport. The word Gandharvapuram is very significant in this verse. Sometimes in the forest a very big castle appears, and this is called a castle in the air. Actually, this castle does not exist anywhere but in one's imagination. This is called Gandharvapura. In the material forest, the conditioned soul sometimes contemplates great castles and skyscrapers, and he wastes his energy for such things, hoping to live in them peacefully with his family forever. However, the laws of nature do not allow this. When he enters such castles, he temporarily thinks that he is very happy, even though his happiness is impermanent. His happiness may last for a few years, but because the owner of the castle has to leave the castle at the time of death, everything is eventually lost. This is the way of worldly transactions. Such happiness is described by Vidyapati as the happiness one derives upon seeing a drop of water in the desert. The desert is heated by scorching sunshine, and if we want to reduce the desert temperature, we need huge amounts of water. Millions and millions of gallons. What effect will one drop have? Water certainly has value, but one drop of water cannot reduce the heat of the desert. In this material world, everyone is ambitious, but the heat is very scorching. What will an imaginary castle in the air do to help? Srila Vidyapati has therefore sung Talala Saikute Vare Bindusam Sutta Mita Ramani Samaj. The happiness of family life, friends and society is compared to a drop of water in the scorching desert. The entire material world is busy trying to attain happiness because happiness is the prerogative of the entity, the living being. Continuing, text 8. Sometimes the merchant in the forest wants to climb the hills and mountains. Why would he want to climb the hills and mountains? What is he looking for, the merchant? He's looking for something there that he can sell. Something that's going to... He has a fruit of desire to get there. He's wandering everywhere looking for something that's going to make him money, which is the seed of his happiness. Then he'll go back to the city with it. So he goes climbing the hills and mountains. But due to insufficient footwear, his feet are pricked by small stones, fragments, and by thorns on the mountain. Being pricked by them, he becomes very aggrieved. Sometimes a person who is very attached to his family becomes overwhelmed with hunger. And due to his miserable condition, he becomes furious with his family members. Purport. The ambitious conditioned soul wants to be very happy in this material world with his family. But he's compared to a traveler in the forest who desires to climb a hill full of thorns and small stones. As stated in the previous verse, the happiness derived from society, friendship, and love is like a drop of water in the scorching heat of the desert. One way want to become very great and powerful in society, but this is like attempting to climb a hill full of thorns. Someone may he has some ambition, climbing to the top of society, but how difficult it is to get there. And what he wants, what he's seeking, isn't actually there anyway. And he has to undergo so much torture and thorny path that causes so much difficulty for him as he goes there. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur compares one family to a high mountain, to high mountains. Becoming happy in their association is like a hungry man's endeavoring to climb a mountain full of thorns. Almost 99.9% of the population is unhappy in family life, despite all the attempts being made to satisfy the family members. In the Western countries, due to the dissatisfaction of the family members, there is actually no family life. There are many cases of divorce, and out of dissatisfaction, the children leave the protection of their parents. Especially in this age of Kali, family life is being reduced. Everyone is becoming self-centered, because that is the law of nature. People don't care even about family life, which family life means you have to compromise. They have to put the family at the center, not their own personal needs. So people, when the family life isn't bringing them happiness, and the result is people are only thinking of their own needs, and therefore they're very, very, very lonely. So everyone is becoming self-centered, because that is the law of nature. Even if one has sufficient money to maintain a family, the situation is such that no one is happy in family life. Consequently, according to the Vanashrama institution, one has to retire from family life in middle age. Pancho sodram vanam brajet. One should voluntarily retire from family life at the age of 50 and go to Vrindavan or a forest. This is recommended by Srila Prahlad Maharaj. Tatsaromanye suravarji tadehiram sadasamud vignadiyama sadgrahat hitvatma patam griyamanda kupam vanam guto yad dharamashvieta. There is no benefit in transferring from one forest to another. One must go to the Vrindavan forest and take shelter of Govinda. That will make one happy. The International Society for Krishna Consciousness is therefore constructing a Krishna Balaram temple to invite its members as well as outsiders to come and live peacefully in a spiritual atmosphere. That will help one become elevated to the transcendental world and return home back to Godhead. Text 9. The conditioned soul in the material forest is sometimes swallowed by a python. Or what else does a python do when it captures you? There are two things. It either swallows you whole and digests you, or
suffocate.
Yeah, it crushes you. It wraps itself around you and crushes you. At such a time, he is left lying in the forest like a dead person, devoid of consciousness and knowledge. Sometimes other poisonous snakes bite him. Being blind to his consciousness, he falls down into a dark well of hellish life with no hope of being rescued. So that's the sleep. That's the shelter of everyone. The sleep, kalasarp. Sleep, everyone takes shelter of sleep. Text 10. Sometimes, in order to have a little insignificant sex enjoyment, one searches after debauched women. In this attempt, one is insulted and chastised by the women's kinsmen. This is like going to take honey from a beehive and being attacked by the bees. Sometimes, after spending lots of money, one may acquire another woman for some extra sense enjoyment. Unfortunately, the object of sense enjoyment, the woman, is taken away or kidnapped by another devotee. Sometimes the living entity is busy counteracting the natural disturbances of freezing cold, scorching heat, strong wind, excessive rainfall, and so forth. When he's unable to do so, he becomes very unhappy. Sometimes he is cheated in business transactions one after another in this way by cheating. Living entities create enmity amongst themselves. Purport. This is an example of the struggle for existence. The attempt to counteract the onslaught of material nature. That's what this Prabhupada refers to as the struggle for existence. It's the attempt to counteract the onslaught of material nature. This creates enmity in society. And consequently, society is filled with envious people. One person is envious of another, and this is the way of the material world. The Krishna Consciousness Movement aims at creating an atmosphere of non-envy. Of course, it is not possible for everyone to become Krishna conscious, but the Krishna Consciousness Movement can create an exemplary society wherein there is no envy. So that's a challenge. And that is the challenge, or one of the great challenges that Prabhupada is offering us. On the forest path of material existence, sometimes a person is without wealth, and due to this, he does not have a proper home, bed, or sitting place, nor proper family enjoyments. He therefore goes to beg money from others, but when his desires are not fulfilled by begging, he wants to borrow or steal the property of others. Thus he is insulted in society. Purport. The principle of beg, borrow, or steal are very appropriate in this material world. When one is in want, he begs, borrows, or steals. If begging is unsuccessful, he borrows. If he cannot pay, he steals. When he is caught, he is insulted. This is the law of material existence. No one can live here very honestly. Therefore, by trickery, cheating, begging, borrowing, or stealing, one tries to satisfy his senses. Thus, no one in this material world is living peacefully. Text 13. Due to monetary transactions, relationships become very strained and end in enmity. Sometimes the husband and wife walk on the path of material progress, and to maintain the relationship, they work very hard. Sometimes due to scarcity of money or due to disease conditions, they are embarrassed and almost die. Is everyone happy? Prabhupada's purport. In this material world, there are many transactions between peoples and society as well as between nations. But gradually, these end in enmity between the two parties. Similarly, in the marriage relationship, monetary transactions are sometimes overpowered by the dangerous conditions of material life. One then becomes diseased or monetarily embarrassed. In the modern age, most countries have developed economically, but due to business exchanges, relationships seem to be strained. Finally, wars are declared between nations, and as a result of these upheavals, there is destruction all over the world and people suffer heavily. So this is the description of Jadbharat, of why we should not allow our mind to become filled with material desires, because that causes us to again and again enter the forest of material enjoyment, seeking happiness where it doesn't exist. Okay, we'll stop here. Questions? Any questions or comments? Thank you very much. No questions. So if one has great wealth, then there's no need to go into the forest to gain something, to bring back and sell. So if we can somehow acquire reacquire or awaken our already possessed wealth of Krishna consciousness, there won't be need to seek our happiness in the material world. Who rules? What is the machine? Materialistic society or the materialistic culture. Everyone gets caught in the machine and angry at it, but what catches them as they desire to enjoy? So we, instead of having the rage against the machine, the rage should be against the desire to enjoy. Try to tell that to someone who's 14 or 15 or 16 or 17 or 18 or 19 or 20, etc. Or 80 or 90 or 100 or 110 or 120 or 130 or 476 and 822. Yeah. Any other deep questions?
In this last bit, Swami Prabhupada thinks when he says, similarly in the marriage relationship, monetary transactions sometimes overcome the dangerous conditions of material.
That marriage relationships are ruined by lack of monetary success, because if a man is unable to earn money to support the family, the wife can get very, very critical and leave him and try to find some other security or shelter, something like that. Yep. Okay. We shall end here. Next Wednesday, we'll have class, but a different kind of class about Krishna's birth. Probably not. Huh?
Not maybe.
Not maybe? Well, probably not means it's leaning a little in the other direction. But let's see. Any other? Okay. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jay, Jad Bharat ki jay, avoiding the forest of material enjoyment ki jay.